The following podcast contains explicit language.
The White House put out some talking points tonight. This is what they say. The president was entirely correct. Both sides of the violence in Charlottesville acted inappropriately and bear some responsibility. There's another one that says he has been a voice for unity and calm. This is Alice in Wonderland stuff. I think we saw the president's true colors today, and I'm not sure they were red, white, and blue.
We see the soul of him when he's flying off the handle and when he's tweeting.
Why, for the president, does it seem easier to suggest U.S. intelligence operatives are behaving like Nazis than to call these actual Nazis Nazis?
Hello and welcome to Trumpcast, the show about the man who says he actually owns one of the largest wineries in the United States, in Charlottesville. Actually, it's not even close to being one of the largest wineries, even on the East Coast. I'm Jacob Weisberg, here with Virginia Heffernan.
Are you calling the president a liar, Jacob? I think that's tantamount to sedition here.
He's been known to be hyperbolic on occasion.
Yeah, but just be cautious. Let's fact check carefully. We want to get the facts first before we pass judgment.
I think his winery produces 36,000 cases of wine a year. The Gallo winery produces 10 times that.
Fake news.
Yeah, that's what he was yelling at the press conference yesterday. Jesus Christ. Did you see it?
Oh, my God. I think we might need to break out a bottle of Antifa. That's anti-fascist wine from a different winery in order to discuss this one. I don't think the good is beating the bad today.
People were very upset last night, and Jamel Bowie is going to join us in a minute. But, you know, I'm a perennial optimist. I sort of saw the end of the Trump presidency. Now, I've seen it before. But I think there's a way in which he's not able to govern after what he said yesterday.
Like in a 25th Amendment way?
No, I don't think his own cabinet will remove him. But in a completely incapacitated, ineffectual way, his government falling apart and essentially, you know, he could be a lame duck for 3 years. He could be a lame duck until he's impeached. But I don't see him having any potential to be an effective president after that.
I am going to park my faith in you today, and let's see where Jamel is.
After this, Virginia, we're going to do a Slate Plus segment. I have a question I want to ask you, which is basically, what are the kind of decent people in the Trump administration, like Dina Powell and maybe Gary Cohn and these people, H.R. McMaster, people we're kind of looking to protect us from Donald Trump. Okay. What should they do now? Do we want them to stay or do we want them to go?
I mean, maybe they should just continue to be concerned, write in their diaries, vote their time. Maybe something will happen with infrastructure. Or maybe they should call him out and call the crisis that it is and issue an official censure. I mean, these are not difficult moral decisions, right?
We're going to talk about this after the show on our Slate Plus segment. Join Slate Plus today, and you'll be able to hear that and get lots of other bonus content from Slate Podcasts, plus an ad-free feed. Go to slate.com/TrumpCastPlus. I also want to mention the live show we have coming up in Austin, Texas.
Can't wait.
Austin has the best barbecue, and we're going to get some Virginia.
Can there be ranch dressing? We don't tell anyone, but ranch dressing is what I do in Austin.
Ew.
There's barbecue, there's people, and there is TrumpCast live.
You can have whatever you want on your barbecue.
We have special guests.
And it's going to be fun, and you can get tickets for it at slate.com/live. That's slate.com/live. I'm Jacob Weisberg here with Virginia Heffernan and Jamel Bowie for a kind of emergency meeting of the TrumpCast Council of Elders.
Before they disband us.
Yeah, exactly. Trump will have to fire us before we quit. Actually, if he fires himself, we will quit. That's part of our deal.
it's written in the contract.
But we're here because of the amazing, astonishing, horrifying press conference Trump had yesterday at Trump Tower when he, what else can we say, defended white supremacists, people who protested on the side of neo-Nazis and members of the KKK, and there's been an incredible reaction overnight in the past few hours. But I guess I wanted to start by asking you, Jamel, what Trump said that was new. I mean, what did he do yesterday that he hasn't done in one form or another before?
I think the difference between yesterday and most of his statements regarding sort of racism and such was that he just he was passionate about it, which I think took people aback. He was clearly very animated by the idea that the Unite the Right protesters were in any way disruptive or in the wrong. And I think the extent to which he had no qualms trying to position those protesters as the victims in the situation was also jarring. I think you also can't escape the fact that someone died on Saturday. Someone was killed as a result of the white supremacist protest, or, you know, one of the person currently in custody is an alleged member of all of that. So if nothing else, the fact that even if nothing Trump said was new or different, the fact that he said it in that context made it, I think, all the more shocking.
I mean, there is a funny line, isn't there, between, on the one hand, Islamophobia and anti-Latino racism, which just in many ways are code for other kinds of bigotry. But you can kind of get away with that. But you can't get away in the same way with explicitly anti-Black racism or anti-Semitism. Is that right? Is that the line he crossed?
You used to not be able to get away with Islamophobia and saying Mexicans are racists. Then Trump moved that line, and now you can get away with that and can't get away with this other thing. And now it remains to be seen if he can get away with this other thing. I mean, I thought there was a lot in... I want to hear a little more also, Jamel, your take on what he said about Robert E. Lee and the equivalency with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. That seemed important to him. And I know that's something that you've written about. You know, it was important to Trump's argument that he single out certain of the, what do you say, like fine young men or, you know, with the Unite the Right crowd who were just there to defend the statue of Robert E. Lee. And if we object to the statue of Robert E. Lee, where will it lead next? You know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, he shot that back at the press. And that seemed like an interesting detour, but also something that you could illuminate for us.
Yeah. So two things. First, on the question of did Trump cross a line with anti-Black racism, I think that is exactly it. There's an extent to which even before Trump, anti-Latino and anti-Muslim racism were basically not socially acceptable. Like, if you made those kind of statements in kind of polite company, you would get criticized for it. But they were, at the very least, you could dog whistle towards them, you could gesture towards them and kind of escape major sanction. They occupied the role that, say, anti-Asian racism played in the 80s, and even to some extent now. But in defending quite openly the white supremacists and neo-Nazis who came to Charlottesville, I think Trump did cross that line into apologizing for anti-Black racism, which I think across the board in our politics is kind of verboten, even as dog whistles are still in wide use in politics. To get to your question though, Virginia, that is something I did find shocking, right? I've spent entirely too much time of my life reading a neo-Confederate apology and kind of immersed in that world. And that comparison, if Robert E. Lee now, then what about George Washington next, is sort of like typical of those arguments, elevating Lee. And Trump also mentioned Stonewall Jackson, and there's also a Stonewall Jackson statue in Charlottesville, elevating those two figures with men like Washington and Jefferson. And even among mainstream conservatives, you see statements like, oh, there's a slippery slope between taking on these statues and taking on someone like Jefferson. And I think
first they came for the Confederate generals.
Right.
Then they came for the ordinary Confederate soldiers. Then they came for the founding fathers.
So if I'm reading that stuff like in good faith, then I think the error they're making is that they're saying, okay, Lee was a slaveholder, Jefferson was a slaveholder, so what distinguishes the two? Why not take Jefferson down along with Lee? The answer is that yes, Jefferson was a slaveholder, Washington were slaveholders, but the reason we memorialize them is not because of their slaveholding. We memorialize them because, you know, one wrote the Declaration of Independence, one led Continental armies and basically like formed the model for the presidency. And while their public memory should include the fact that they owned slaves, and I think it should be pretty central to how we remember them, in terms of memorializing, there is material for creating sort of a broadly acceptable, a broadly a narrative that everyone can buy into. I mean, that was basically the whole project of the musical Hamilton. Lee is only famous because he led Confederate armies. If secession had never happened, if the Confederacy had never come into existence, Lee would have lived his life and died as an obscure member of the United States military. His meaning is you can't untangle it from the Confederacy. And if you look at even sort of like a cursory history of the memorialization of the Confederacy, it all pops up in the 1890s and 1900s, 1910s as Jim Crow is being codified. It was, these things were explicitly raised as symbols of Jim Crow and of white supremacy. So Trump's comparison there is, I mean, it's dumb. It doesn't really make any sense. And the notion that there's some slippery slope is also dumb.
I getting at first the pact made after the Civil War and you know the general consensus that Lee lost and was like on the side against the Republic, the pact that we now share, and then finally getting down to bedrock with what is this country all about, the one that Orrin Hatch's brother died for fighting the Nazis. That is another thing, the support beam that Trump is willing to kick down. It just felt like anarchy or chaos. I see people reviving Jeb Bush's prediction that Trump would be the chaos president, that he was the chaos candidate. And it really was like, there is really nothing sacred here. I mean,
if you look at the transcript of that press conference yesterday, yeah, it keeps being punctuated by the phrase, reporters continue yelling indistinctly.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it was kind of like a fight between the reporters and Trump. I mean, it was like totally like undignified, even as, you know, as any kind of presidential appearance or press conference. But I guess the thing I want to ask both of you about, and maybe starting with you, Jamel, is about the sort of context for what's going on here. So one way to look at what's happened in Charlottesville is you have an emboldened alt-right, and that Trump's election has given permission to these people, and that, you know, and that the racist right is on the march. Another way of looking at it is that we are going through a moment, a sort of racial justice moment, and the movement against mass incarceration, against unjustified police killings and violence against African Americans, and the taking down of these Confederate statues and monuments all over the South, and the question about whether you should do that or not, but the fact that it's happening is a kind of revolutionary moment in the other direction, and that what you're getting is a reaction to that, which you got to expect you're going to have to some extent, but that the motive power is towards racial justice and racial change. So, you know, you could take a very negative view of what's happening, or in a funny way, you could take a positive view of what's happening. How do you see it?
I mean, I think I see it as kind of a both and. I think there is this larger backlash that has its roots in Obama's election and has intensified as I think the demands of groups like Black Americans and transgender Americans and immigrants have intensified over the past couple of years. But it's also true, as you just said, that we're also in this moment where there is a kind of a growing consensus among the need to move forward on arresting racial inequality, arresting inequality in the justice system, of reconfiguring and rethinking our public memory. And I'll say that this has always been the dynamic. The backlash to Reconstruction happened during Reconstruction as well as sort of afterwards. The backlash to the Civil Rights Movement happened during the Civil Rights Movement as well as afterwards. And the larger question is sort of what is the broader context under which all of this is happening? And so to use Reconstruction as an example, the initial backlash couldn't really sustain itself because the federal government was still mostly committed to reconstructing the South in a way that preserved sort of Black autonomy and furthered Black political power. When that commitment ended, then the backlash took the form that we ultimately got, that it succeeded.
I mean, lots of these statues, you know, were put up not after the Civil War. They were put up in the 1920s when you had this kind of pro-Confederate resurgence, the period of Birth of a Nation, and when the Klan came back and mm-hmm. became sort of reborn as an organization. We never had, after the Civil Rights Movement, you know, any kind of Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, we never readdressed that history. The approach of the federal government was to change the laws and get people to move on, which without calling white Southerners fully to account. That's what's happening in a way now. I mean, these statues should have come down in the 1960s and 1970s. Instead, they're happening in the late 2010s. But there's not much doubt in my mind that those Confederate statues are coming down. I mean, not necessarily every single one of them in every place, but hundreds of Confederate monuments are going to come down in the South, and they are going to be replaced by civil rights monuments over the next generation.
I mean, I promised my mom I wouldn't slag off UVA today, and I won't. I know Jamel and I have talked about both being alumni and having different feelings about it. But the idea post-civil rights that things like the Robert E. Lee Monument could survive in Charlottesville, that kind of the Southern antebellum masquerade that, like, we saw Jamel and I did at parties and at ways people comported themselves in sometimes explicitly, implicitly racist ways in social life and culture, was that, well, the South will live on in culture, like it'll live on in things like statues, and we'll, like, let them have that, like this gesture of, like, you know, watching Gone with the Wind, or, you know, the guilty pleasure of going to parties where the staff basically stands in slave uniforms, and some of the country parties. Jamel, I don't know if that was still true when you were there. And then the culture, I mean, I guess I'm really influenced by, did you all see the Vice HBO documentary about the Charlottesville, about Charlottesville? It was like a kind of like Eichmann and Charlottesville profile. I thought mostly of this, one of the neo-Nazis whose name I think is Christopher Cardwell. I'll look it up. But he said the purpose of the demonstration was to make manifest what had been digital. So, you know, prove that neo-Nazis are not just a collection of memes, but they're flesh and blood people armed really to the teeth with semi-automatic weapons, and that this isn't just a kind of cultural kabuki or a cultural play acting that goes on online where people distribute, you know, hilarious pictures of Adolf Hitler, but that they can actually demonstrate and actually kill someone. And at the end of this documentary, I recommend everyone watch it. I mean, it's like a first draft of like an Eichmann in Jerusalem. Like, you really saw the banality of the logic, the intensity of the weapons. I mean, this guy takes off his weapons at the end of the day, celebrating the death of Heather Heyer, and he's unloading these weapons on the bed, and it's just like one after another in this jokey way, pulling out the guns, naming them, claiming he's lost track of how many there are. I just can't believe one man's body had this many guns on it. And he just is like, we won. Like, we won the day. We are real. We're not just a set of tropes and memes and, you know, bots. Sorry, Christopher Cantwell. I want to go back and say that's the name of the neo-Nazi who's, among other things, profiled in this documentary. I think it's called, well, now I'm leaving it to Jason to figure it out, but I think it's called Terror and Something in Charlottesville. Vice and HBO managed to get it up, I think, on Sunday right after the march.
So let's talk about where we are then. So, you know, you have this horrible, violent, revanchist cult, and the president, shockingly, morally, and stupidly politically, has not been able to make a clear denunciation that, you know, something that any moral or political idiot would know to do. Can he govern the country? I mean, we got the message right before we started recording that he's now disbanding these two councils, his manufacturing council and his economic council, basically because everybody on them, all the CEOs, Republican CEOs on them, were quitting so fast that he, you know, could barely disband it before all of them quit. How can he run the country?
I mean, it is interesting to make a list of the different people that Trump takes shots at during a period of his life. So it was McConnell before this and the saber rattling at Korea. But last night he had McCain in his sights. I mean, it was just like you know, on the one hand, it's madness to go down the road of his tone poems and his, you know, fury. But that particular press conference, you know, he hated the press. It had more than usual flare up of his immune system and like chronic abuse, like echolalic abuse of that phrase fake news that he just threw out to shut everyone down. And then also John McCain. So he wanted to remind everyone that John McCain, and he had like, I don't know if you guys can remember this or render it, but he had some like very sarcastic way of talking about McCain, like, oh, John McCain, the one who XYZ. in response to one of the reporter's questions.
Virginia, I mean, he's done that before. The question is, you know, let me ask Jamel, has he now done something that has undermined his legitimacy to the extent that we've essentially got a lame duck president in the White House whom, whether they will move to impeach him or attack him directly, no one is going to follow or support or take seriously? Is that the situation we're now in?
Yeah, I've seen some folks refer to both Saturday and now Tuesday as being Trump's Katrina moment. And that phrase got a lot of overuse during the Obama administration. But the way it's been used here, I think, is actually interesting. And here, Katrina moment means not just a disaster, either policy-wise or public relations-wise, but one that reveals the fundamental weakness or fundamental flaw of the political figure or of the administration.
I mean, I don't want to jump on that, but I mean, I guess I'm feeling a little bit less sanguine than you guys today. That might not be fair, but you know, we'd been waiting for something like Katrina. It's always like cited as some kind of FEMA event, the thing that would really show who Trump is or if he could rise to the occasion. This is not that. This is not an act of God. This is an act of emboldened and materially empowered and supported with, you know, the nexus of Bannon and Gorka and Miller, and then, you know, Trump's countenancing. It's like something beyond countenancing. Like, he's entertained these ideas. He's, you know, given succor to them sometimes. And on these platforms that he frequents, and everything from Breitbart to some of the Russian sites, he's participated in the, like, influence ops around them, the tangle of information. Anyway, the point is, I think this is the president just flexing his muscles and taking shots at McCain and the other cuck Republicans who he now hates. And they still aren't saying anything specific. They're saying they're concerned. They're creasing their eyebrow, their whatever. But it's like potentially another Access Hollywood. It's just crazy to me. Yeah, I don't think it's Katrina. I think it's like the Nazis and the Russians are fucking here. Like, it just, that's what it feels like. And we have a president who's a Nazi sympathizer. And that's what he told us.
Well, I may have said this before, but I think for that reason, he did cross a bridge this week that he can't uncross. And boy, every week we say this was his most catastrophic week as president. He can't possibly do anything worse next week. And every week he manages to outdo himself. And it's only Wednesday. I want to thank both of you. Jamel, Virginia, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for our show today. Virginia, anything you want to plug?
I don't think of this as plugging. I think of it as more like a command, an order. Follow Real TrumpCast on Twitter. You know, you follow the substitutes, you follow those bros that love to talk about how bad Trump is. We are not that. Except no substitutes. We are the first and only real podcast on real Donald Trump. It's called At Real TrumpCast. Follow us today.
I might mention a Slate show you might not have listened to. It's Slate Money. It goes out Saturday morning, hosted by the excellent Felix Salmon with Jordan Weissman and Anna Zemanski. It's really an essential briefing on business and finance. And I know this week they're going to be talking about Trump ending his two business councils.
I need to hear that. I love Slate Money.
TrumpCast was produced by Jason DeLeon. Virginia and I want to thank Jamel Bowie for joining us from Charlottesville.
Thanks, Jamel.
And thanks for listening to TrumpCast.